Good evening. Just a couple of things that Tim missed out. The toilets are that way, the exit is that way, and the coffee is not strong enough to keep you awake. Well, I've been told there's plenty of it, so if you feel you're falling asleep, just rush over there. Second notice is that I actually once got up. I was doing a service in, I got a feeling it was Chatham, and partway through my sermon, or whatever you like to call it, I realised it was very boring. And truthfully, I stood there and I thought, I am so bored with this. I hate to think what they feel. So, you know, if you get down that route tonight, if you start falling asleep, start getting bored, shout out and do something. And lastly, I don't possess a watch. No, that's a lie. I've got a watch. I don't wear it. So, right, okay. Yeah, so if you find we're getting on towards 10 o'clock, please let me know. But I don't know how I got into doing this tonight. Graham some time ago said, do you fancy doing something with us? I said, yeah. And I think I said it a couple of months ago when we did the introduction, that I was going to do Hebrews because I was studying that at the time. And then Graham turned in and said that he was doing it. And while we're sitting there drinking coffee, I said, I'll do Exodus then. Only on the basis of, it seems to be a book which is important. Nothing else. Not that I was an expert. I'm still not an expert. And I'm sure sitting around here this evening, people know far more than I do. But I just want to go through the picture of it. I'm going to jump chapters and try and keep in the right order. But this book, it is part of a bigger story. It's part of God's plan for his people. And it's really important to remember where we start off back in Genesis, that God made some promises and instructions, and they're to do with people growing. First of all, he's got the creation. He says to man and woman, they are to sort of go and have children and multiply. And that is part of God's blessing upon this earth. But he turns around to people like Abraham and makes him a promise about his people and what he wants to do. But the big story is that God blesses man, they rebelled, and God chooses to restore the relationship they had. That is a big story, and this book of Exodus is a continuation from Genesis. You can't look at them separately. You can't look in isolation at any of the Old Testament books like this, because there are things that refer back, and there are things that you don't know yet. And it's rather strange. You're looking through this book, you're saying, what about this? And you don't find that until a later book in the Old Testament. So it's something that's very difficult to draw out other than to go through the story, pick out a few interesting things. But I want to start with a couple of comments by a guy called John Drain, who was watching TV many years ago. And this guy was speaking. I thought, wow, here's a guy who's a theologian, intelligent, and he speaks at my level. I found that amazing. Anybody could get seat that low. But he says, if we are to understand the books of the Hebrew Bible fully, we must delve into the reality of the world in which they were written. And what you will find as you read Exodus is you get a lot of questions because you just don't understand things, because we're looking from a context we know about Christ. We know that he died and rose from the dead. We know what's going to happen in the future. But back here when the book was written, the people didn't have anything like that. So God is speaking into a situation that doesn't know anything about Christ. So very often when we read the Old Testament, we don't understand it because we don't understand the situation it's being spoken into. Something that I found interesting, it's just a comment, but I'll just throw it at you. The law books are sacred to Judaism, Christianity and Islam. And you sit down and you think, hang on a minute. You know, we've got a common root in a sense, something that we all believe in. How come we're so different today? But I'm not going to answer that one. And the final comment from him is, Exodus is not just a story, but it's a deeply held belief by modern day Jews. It's a deeply held, whereas from a Christian perspective, we often get taught these stories in the Bible when we're young, and we grow up with these stories, and they are great stories. But what he's saying is, it's not just a story. What's written here is a deeply held belief. And I guess in some ways we've got to grasp hold of that as we look at this book of Exodus. I'm going to deal with it in two parts, because yeah, the simple way of looking at it is chapters up to 19 or 17, 18, somewhere around there, where we're looking at the famous stories that we all know leading to the Exodus. And after that, we jump into a part. Now, if you look at my Bible, it's got masses of colouring for the early chapters. When it gets into how to build, you know, the temple and things like this, there's colouring starts fading away, because I sit there and I read through all sorts of things. I think, I just don't really understand what this is. Why do I need to know today how big something is or what it's made of? Why do I need to know that today? And I'm not certain whether I'll answer that one, but hopefully I'll give you some reasons for why it's important. But the story starts off, as I said in Genesis, you've got Abraham, Isaac and Jacob leaving and heading off down to Egypt. And they arrive there to meet up with Joseph. And they have come down there because of a famine. And they find Joseph is one of the boss guys, number two honcho to the Pharaoh. And the story of Exodus begins 400 years later, after they've been down there enjoying themselves, living in the sunshine. You know, I guess they did scuba diving and things like that to keep themselves going. But the story starts with a statement by Pharaoh that, hey, you know, Israel are growing in numbers. We've got a problem here, folks, because just as they are growing in numbers, they're becoming a military opposition. If the enemy attack us and they join them, we've got big problems. And by saying that, he opposes what God has commanded. Yeah, God told them to multiply. And now Pharaoh's saying, we've got to do something about this. So he is opposing God. And he fears this military threat. And he deals with it in three ways. First of all is enslavement. So he puts the Israelites to working hard to making cities and building, making bricks and all sorts of things like that. Then he commands the midwives to kill the boys at birth. And they come up with this clever idea that Israel women are different and the babies drop out too quick, and hey folks, we can't do that. And finally comes up with the fact that he says all the boys must be drowned in the Nile. And in this, Pharaoh is attempting to destroy God's blessings for the future. It's not just sort of genocide or anything like that. He's actually trying to oppose God. And this is the whole picture in this first part of this book, is that it's really a spiritual battle that's going on. It's not just horrible men. It's not just nasty things. It's a spiritual battle that is going on. By the way, the pages are big, but so's the writing, so don't worry too much. But so we move on to this story, into chapter 2, and we have this picture of despair and hopelessness, picture where Israel is suffering. And into it a child is born, into a Levite family, and that will become important later on. What you'll notice in Exodus as you read it, that there's a lot of things that are said that are vital and important like the fact that he's born into a Levite family is very important to the Jewish nation. But there are a lot of things that you expect to be said that aren't. It makes it a real pain to read it, you know, to understand what's going on. But he's born into this family, and it's quite amazing that this is God's response to what Pharaoh is doing. Just what I'm going to do tonight as we go through, I'll just pick up on a couple of interesting things just to keep you awake. But yeah, when we get this story of Moses being put in a basket and you get this nice pretty picture of him floating down the Nile, if you remember, and looking back, God did something in Noah's time. And they built an ark and they covered it in pitch or tar to make it watertight. And the floods rose and destroyed the people. And God started a new generation, new people off for him there. And you've got a similar picture here, looking back, that Moses and Noah both were saved from drowning. That an ark was used to carry them to safety. Both of them were used to create a new people for God. So there's often things that we saw as a story back years ago when you're in Sunday school, which actually is sort of looking back at the history, looking at God's working of his plan. Well, Moses grows up, and there's not a lot said about his growth, other than he's brought up by his mother, and he becomes one of the leaders in Egypt. But there's some events that happen that lead him away. And he kills an Egyptian. And then he goes to sort out a couple of Israelites who are having a fight. And one of them points out that he's aware that he killed him. And so he runs. And in fact, Pharaoh is after him. So from that point on, he becomes an enemy. He becomes a fugitive and has to leave. And he goes to, I was going to say Horeb, but that's leading on. He goes off and he gets married and he has children and he's having a wonderful life leading the flocks around. And he suddenly finds himself being led to Horeb, or later on becomes Sinai, and sort of, you wonder why this is happening. Why is it? The scripture tells us he's led far away, and it's God drawing him, God leading him. But life in Egypt is still very bad, and so we get God's response again to his people's cry. He remembers the covenant he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So we move on to chapter 3 and 4, which in a sense is now the burning bush, which is again one of these popular stories that everybody knows. Moses is now 80. I guess it's time to settle down for him, really, because I'm not quite that old, and I'd love to settle down and take things easy. But he is just starting out on a new sort of episode of his life with God. The burning bush. And it's a shame Wayne isn't here, because I was going to turn around and say to him, not that famous pop group from Gillingham Baptist Church, but this Graham's most probably the only one who knows what I'm talking about here. But, eh? Oh, and Suzanne, you're that old. But yeah, we get this episode of the burning bush, which is a great story. But here God reveals himself to Moses. And what sort of questions that come to your mind as you read? How much actually does Moses know about God? Yeah, well, does he know a lot about God because his mother taught him? Or does he know absolutely nothing? Or is it a mixture? We don't know this, but all we know is that God leads him and reveals himself to him and reveals to him this plan of deliverance. And that there's a number of things that you draw out in Exodus again and again and again, which are things like deliverance. Yeah, it's God's plan, and again and again and again, he does it. something happens and he delivers his people. But God reveals his plan. But what's exciting, verse 6, is that he reminds Moses of his past history. That's why you start to wonder how much he knows. Yeah? When God says, yeah, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, does Moses understand what is being said? Or does he just have this idea that it's something really important? But God makes a promise to deliver his people. And again, this is something that is key, that God makes promises and he carries them out. And if you go through this, one of the themes again and again and again is the people of Israel look as though they actually doubt what God has promised. The responses to many things, the golden calf, for example, God has promised, but we're going to do our own thing. And it's, it's one of the things that runs through, that God makes a promise. He makes promises to Moses. And we'll go on in a minute, but what does Moses do? But Moses is going to be the means of deliverance. God is going to do the work, but Moses will be the one who gets up there and approaches Pharaoh. And what does Moses do? He doesn't turn around like I did to Graham and say, I'd love to join you, Graham. He turns around 5 times. He doubts the wisdom of God. He questions whether he's got it right. And God in the end gives him 3 signs in chapter 4 that, just prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that he is dealing with Almighty God. And yet, again and again, he doubts him. He questions things. He turns around and says, I'm not eloquent. Bernie Pinner is not eloquent, I can guarantee that. But somehow, God can use people. Exodus chapter 4 is time when he's moving away, and his enemy, the Pharaoh, is now dead. Time has moved on, and it is time for the Exodus to begin. Moses is told to perform these wonders, and God says to him that he will harden Pharaoh's heart. That's one of these questions that has come up, that, God is hardening someone's heart. What about free will? I thought my God was a God who allowed me to make choices. And yet, somehow at this point, God says, I will harden his heart. And in the passage, what he's talking about is making him stubborn. And in a sense, God allows us free will. But sometimes we get to a point where he says, all right, that's the way you want it. That's the way you're going to have it. And that is what happens in this case with Pharaoh, as we see later on. But Israel is not just any nation. In verse 22, he talks about Israel about being the firstborn son. They're special to God. They've got a special relationship. And when you see the firstborn son, I'm sure you're sort of going, the 10th plague, the firstborn son. All these things hang together. It's quite amazing. The number of things that you read in Exodus that you can look forward to. Now, with hindsight, I guess, we can see things that are happening. We get something about the circumcision. And I'm not going to ask the men to put their hands up and say whether they've had it done or not. But, it seems to crop out of nowhere. And this is what the writer does. You're reading something, all of a sudden something jumps out. You think, why? Why has it been put here? It's just that short passage which talks about God reminding Moses of his command to Abraham in Genesis 17, that boys are to be circumcised. And it just jumps out. Dare we ask the question, should it happen today? But we sort of move on through this passage and finally come to where the confrontation happens. And that happens from chapter 5 to 15. It's a big part of Exodus, this. And it's at the really, in a sense, the exciting bit of Exodus, because we see everything's happening. And in chapter 5 is the first encounter that Moses comes and he meets up with Pharaoh. And the trouble is, it's not a very productive meeting. And it's a bit strange, isn't it? If God came to me and said, Bernie, I want you to do something. And I went through this process of arguing with him, and he convinces me it's the right thing to do, and he gives me signs and things. When I approach Pharaoh, I'd expect whatever I say will happen. God is on my side. And yet Moses goes in here and he says, yeah, my God has said, let my people go. And Pharaoh turns around and says, who is the Lord? You know, who is your God? And straight away, again, we see this attitude of Pharaoh that's got no respect for Israel's God. In a nation that is full of many, many, many gods. And in fact, Pharaoh himself would be recognized as being the son of the sun god. So we're in a situation where Pharaoh is clearly having a go at Yahweh, having a go at Israel's God. He tells them to get back to work. And the whole story here ends with the supervisor of the Israelites going to Pharaoh, having a moan at him, and then going back to Aaron and Moses and having a right old go at them. And you'd be right in questioning whether the mission is going to fail here. Because it seems like Moses has done what he's told. And yet nothing seems to be working. God speaks to Moses again in chapter 6. And we get things where God five times he says, I will. I will. He says, I am the Lord your God. You know, confirming to Moses who he is and that what he says will happen. He makes promises to him that he will free the people that are enslaved. But verse 9 says they would not listen. The Israelites would not listen because of a broken spirit and the cruel labour that they were going through. So the Israelites are really suffering. They're not listening to Moses. And then we get another one of these bits thrown in at random, or appears to be thrown in at random, where it talks in verse 14 about Aaron being a descendant of the Levites. So this is sort of moving on. And we finally come to Moses meeting up with Pharaoh and the plagues. And I don't want to go into the plagues and tell you all about them, because you will fall asleep. But just simply say that Pharaoh and the gods of Egypt are battling against the God of the Israelites. This is a real battle that's going on. And I guess it's something that, you know, we read it as a story and it's nice in some ways, but we don't capture the whole picture of what's happening. I sort of read this some weeks ago, and I was actually laying in bed where I do a lot of my thinking, and I really got this sense of what, you know, this battle that was going on. It wasn't just, you know, a little bit of blood here messing up the water and things like this. There's a real spiritual warfare going on here. But I want to just mention the blood, because we've already seen that the Nile was the place where Moses was put in and Pharaoh was trying to destroy God's plan. And the first of these miracles, or whatever you like to call it, happens was when they turns water into blood, or makes it look red. And if you go through different commentaries, people will try and tell you about a natural phenomenon that causes this to happen. If you go to Uganda or Africa and you blow your nose, it comes out red because the soil is red. But in no way would I ever doubt that any of these are anything but God performing a miracle, doing something to demonstrate his power. And right at the beginning, we get this whole idea is that water was at the beginning of the story, and it's now here going through to this part of it. Water is something that God uses again and again to draw pictures for us to catch hold of. But in particular, the Nile was where Egypt got a lot of its wealth from. It sustained Egypt because of boats trading and things like that, watering the crops. And here God is showing that he can control everything that exists. There's a warning here as well to Pharaoh, which I guess he just doesn't spot, that the red colour could refer to the blood of the soldiers when they get destroyed later on. And even the fact that the Nile is worshipped as a god is another one of these things that says, yeah, there's a battle going on here. But he goes through all these up until the ninth plague. Then suddenly the story stops in chapter 11 and we get more instructions about the Passover and what is going to happen in the coming days. And I guess the Exodus and the Passover is one of the most famous stories from this book. It's something that certainly every time we come and sit around the communion table, we are told to remember back to the Passover. And it's something, as I said earlier, that this is most probably the thing that the Jews today grasp hold of as their heritage, as something that they carry with them, because God says to them that they've got to remember this every year. They've got to celebrate what is going on. But this whole thing of the 10th plague, it is the climax of what is going on. And it quickly looks at the time. And I'm going to jump over a few pages because, let me just say that the 10th plague, one of the key things in it is you'll notice all the other plagues are reversible. Like God reverses them. This last plague is irreversible in one sense, although you could say, well, God could bring life to all these firstborn. But all the other plagues are reversed. This last plague is really God showing his power over life and death. This last plague is God saying, look, you've come to that point where there is no turning back. You push me one more time, and that is going to be the end. And we all know what happens, and the Israelites are released. They go out with riches, which they didn't take in there, because God had said, ask people to give you things, and people actually, it sounds as though they threw everything at them and said, go, take everything you want. But they then go off into the wilderness, and if you think of the crossing of the Red Sea, all that's happened to them, if you were there, would you not have a sort of sense that God is with you, that God is directing you, that God is orchestrating what is happening? Wouldn't you really have a sense that, hey, wherever I go, it's going to be okay, because I've come through so much, so many difficult times, and God has been there, and he's released us from Egypt, and he's carried us through the Red Sea, and he's destroyed all the Egyptian army. If my God can do that, then wherever he leads me, things are going to be okay. But what we get is after 3 days they complained. What shall we drink? What happens? God supplies water. They complain again. You know, we're getting hungry. Wouldn't it be better if we went back to Egypt and died there? Yeah. They're a right load of whingers. They really are. They just moan every opportunity. They fail to recognise the fact that their God is with them and their God is leading them. And in the end, he appears in a cloud and he says to them, then you will know I am the Lord your God. He had to appear to them in this cloud to give them the evidence to sort of get rid of this lack of trust. But you know the story, it just goes on and on and on. They keep on falling whenever they feel something's not quite right. So we get the story of Jethro coming along and advising Moses, you'll be pleased to know the second half isn't as bad as that. But you know, if you just start grasping hold of this big picture, that God has got a group who are special to him, that he wants to do something with, not just to sort of, you know, bless you or anything. Out of this group of people, he is going to bless the nations. Out of this group of people is going to come some amazing things. And somehow, you've got to grasp hold of the fact that, you know, in this next part, God talks about them being special to him, being priests, and all sorts of wonderful descriptions. And at some point, I guess as a Christian, you turn around and say, well, how God feels about these people, doesn't he feel the same about me today? And yeah, you just grasp this absolutely amazing picture of God leading these people out of slavery for a purpose of creating a nation that was special to him, and a nation that are going to bless the world. And the story goes on, and I must just sort of select something very quickly that might capture things. But yeah, we come to, I guess, then looking at things like the Ten Commandments. And I did it many years ago in church. I turned around and said, right, who can tell me the Ten Commandments? And we got to about the third or fourth and we just fell flat. Yeah? And it's true that things like this, you say, well, why do we not know the Ten Commandments off by heart? Or why do we not know this and this? And it's because, and this is my guess, is that so often when we look at the Old Testament, we see it as the Old Testament. And in our enlightened days, we often get told that the laws are, God's sort of set them aside. They don't apply today because we've got grace rather than law. But Christ said he came not to banish and do away with it, or it came to fulfill it. So the question is, are the Ten Commandments, are the 52 commands afterwards still relevant today as they were then? And what is the purpose of them? Because, so often we hear people talk about Christianity and they say, the problem with Christians and the church is a load of rules that says thou shalt not. Where do they get that from? Well, the Old Testament Ten Commandments start off, thou shalt not. But these Ten Commandments, all commandments, were a blessing to God's people. We look at them as trying to sort of ruin our life in a way. Because it's, how can we sort of do this? How can we do that? But let me just say, the first four commandments concern our conduct towards God. There are certain things that God expects from us. And the rest of them are to do with our conduct towards others. And the important thing to grasp hold of here is that for Israel, there was no such thing as secular and religious. There wasn't a division that we seem to have managed to get today. Because every part of their life was lived in a relationship and in devotion to God. These laws and commandments, however we look at them, are things that are to do with justice, generosity, but they're also to show that God's people are different to the rest of the people. If you go through the Ten Commandments, there's things that happen. I'll just mention one, because you know, I guess most men talk about this one. Yeah, thou shalt not commit adultery. And we all know what it means, don't we? You've gone quiet, haven't you? I'm getting worried now. But, yeah, you know, we've got to look back into those days. What did it mean in those days to commit adultery? Hey, folks, I suppose this is the good news. It's only a sin when a woman is married or engaged to be married. So for a married man to have sex with a single girl was okay. This should be good news to you now. Graham's sort of getting worried here. But there was a penalty. Whatever a man did, there's always a penalty. And if he had sex with a woman, he was then committed to either marrying her, because you could have as many wives as you wanted to in those days, or paying the bride price. Now that can lead us down more dodgy sort of things, because it suggests that a woman is just a possession of her father. You sort of look at how is it that in those days it was okay for something to happen when in our day we've cut a dead line. Yeah, adultery is a married man having sex with another woman other than one he's married to. Where that's not what scripture says. Now I'm only saying that not so you all jump up and down, because I'm sure someone's bound to jump up and down. You ready for this, Tim? But so often we hear about people taking something from the Ten Commandments or the other commandments and using it to their advantage without reference to how it was in these days. We find people taking one commandment and saying, that one's okay, but I don't care about the rest of them. And we've got to be very careful when we do that, because you know, God gave these commandments not to oppress a people, but he gave it to them so that they could enjoy a full relationship with him. It's really important to grasp that when we read the Ten Commandments and the other commandments that follow, that we don't sort of pick and choose the ones that we want that sound good, and that we read into them the simple fact that God was building a people for himself who had to be different to the rest of the people. And we could talk about things like later on, there's a mention about the women who performed in the church and things like that, where we all look at things and we sort of just forget that these people have come out of a very oppressive society where they had loads of gods, did loads of things, or loads of cults around. And God is drawing them out of this society to make them different. Now, I'm trying to look for something because I know I've got to stop soon. But I've lost it somewhere, but I'll just move on. What I was looking for was passage where God says, you are a precious people to me, a kingdom of priests, and just to show that how special and how different these people had to be to the nations around them. But I did mention earlier on, and I've got to close, but that this whole thing about the building of the tabernacle and all the clothing that the priests wore, sometimes I've got to confess, when I read it, I do get lost. I do fall asleep. I do find it rather tedious. But there must be a reason for all this thing being there. Why is it that God gives sort of instructions in fair detail to do something. Why is it that the ark has got to look like this? Why is it that the tabernacle's got to be these dimensions, has got to have certain things in it? And what one of the suggestions, and I'm not sure if I'll be able to explain this as well as other people do, but what one of the themes that they pick out is the fact that God is building heaven on earth, if I can put it that way. That heaven is the place where God resides. And when God comes down to meet his people, he's chosen the ark as the place where he's going to meet them. And so he gives them this blueprint for building this tabernacle with the altar and lampstands and all sorts of things. This is where he is going to reside. This is where people are going to meet with him. And some people suggest that it's really reflecting back to the Garden of Eden. That place where God walked with man, where there's nothing to hide, where they talked with God as they strolled through the gardens. Now God is saying to Israel, build this tabernacle, buy this blueprint, and it's this place where I'm going to meet with you. This is the place where I'm going to reside. I did have a rather strange thought when I was looking at this at one point, because it doesn't say that God lives there. And I think there's sometimes a danger that we think God lives there, and you all know you can't put God there. But this was the place when God wanted to meet with his people that he came. And because of that, God created a place that was worthy of his presence. That the whole idea of the tabernacle was that people went through it, and you're in the outer courts, and there's an altar there for you to offer your sin offering. There's a bowl so you can wash before you go in to the next tent. But it's just this whole picture of an amazing place. Chris and I went on holiday. You can start waking up now. Went on holiday to Madeira. And it's a shame Ernie isn't here tonight, because I used to have interesting discussions with Ernie. Because as some of you know, I come from a Baptist tradition. And I come from a sort of idea where, all this ornate stuff in church, what's it all about? Yeah, God doesn't care about that, folks. Yeah, we're free from all that. You go to Madeira, into some of these churches where I don't know whether it's gold or gold paint, but you walk in and just go, oh, amazing. And you sit down and it's quiet. And you look around and think, that's the tabernacle, isn't it? Where you walk into God's presence and you just go, wow, wow. I can't explain things like cherubim. I think there are things when I was a kid, you used to get these scrapbooks and you used to stick cherubim in there. But I don't know, but I just want to finish and just by saying that you notice the Sabbath is mentioned towards the end of this book a couple of times. And you just get this idea from what God says that it's important. It's important that people meet with him. He turns around and it's in chapter 31. He says, keep a regular meeting with me. If you look at 31:12-18, it's a whole part of it. It's talking about keeping a regular meeting, because this will be a sign between God and Israel. There's a purpose for meeting together that sometimes, and I'm as guilty as everybody else, I think, sometimes we turn as, I won't go to church today. I won't meet regularly with God today because I want to do something else. But he says, and this is the amazing thing. He says, yeah, meet with me. You may know I am the Lord who... I've written this down wrong, I'm sure, but... He's got an intention and purpose of meeting together with his people regularly, that they may commune with one another, that they may build up this relationship. And it says, failure to do it will result in death. And this again is one of these sort of things in scripture where we struggle, don't we? Yeah, I was brought up on the God of love. Yeah. And we used to walk around and say to people, I'm saying this to you in love, brother. And yeah, that was the answer to everything. And yet people turn around so often and say, but if you look in the Old Testament, you see a God who seems to annihilate nations. A God here who says that if you don't keep this regular Sabbath meeting, that you will die. That's rather a bit harsh, isn't it? Just think if Sadhu stood up here next Sunday and said, yeah, if you don't come here every week on Sunday at, is it 10:30? 10:30, then this will be your punishment. That is one way of emptying the church, isn't it? But, hey, what?
Or filling it.
It could be, yeah. But yeah, just think, if you're part of God's holy people, if you're sort of his special person, his special nation, if he's got big, big, big plans for you, then it's your desire to be with him as often as you can. And I think this passage really, we ought to hold on to it a bit more. To take meeting together has been something that is really important. Something that is vital for our life. Let me just finish by saying, when he says, all the way to the back, Exodus 40, we finally get to the end of the book, and I know I've missed out loads and loads and loads, and you'll please that I have, but it turns around and it says that God is over the tabernacle and in the cloud. That's verse 34, chapter 40. And there's a reminder there, and I think it's brilliant that God is taking his people on a journey to Canaan. That's the ultimate goal in this part of the history, to get there. And it's got that verse that says that when the cloud moves, you move. When the cloud stays still, you stay still. And I just wonder in that sense that the phrase that people use today, I think, is see where God's doing something and join him. That the church is about moving and doing the will of God. And therefore the church should be seeking God's will. And you just get to the end of this book and see all they've gone through. And God is still faithful. He's still there with them. He's still holding on to them. And, to me, I've hardly touched the book, honest. There's so much in it, but you just start to see how big and wonderful our God is. That he wants for us so much. And we need to have that close fellowship with him. Not be like the Israelites and turn our backs and do our own thing. Tim, I'm going to hand over to you. I notice you've been making notes.